Can we learn anything from bees? Or from birds or ants, for that matter? Science writer Len Fisher says the study of social animals can tell us a great deal about human behavior. Fisher's written a book called The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life. He told Ann Strange Champs that many animals use the principles of swarm intelligence. So what is swarm intelligence? It's the idea that the group has its own collective wisdom, which is greater than the combined smarts of all the individual members.
Like when you get a flock of birds flying, for example, you see the whole flock moving as one. And people used to think that birds probably had ESP and extrasensory perception because they could all communicate with each other and all move as one. What we now know is that they're moving like that just because each bird is following simple rules of interaction with its neighbours. You know, keep up with the bird in front, keep along the bird alongside, and keep in the general direction of the flock without bashing into anybody. And those three rules are sufficient to lead this amazingly complex behavior of the group as a whole. So that's swarm intelligence in the natural world.
And does swarm intelligence apply mostly to animals? I mean, I'm thinking of birds, fish, ants, but does it also apply to people?
Well, that sort of swarm intelligence, where we're interacting with our neighbors and things build up into a pattern, you see in the streets, if you go out into a crowded street, you see something remarkable happening when the crowd density gets sufficiently high, and that is that the crowd suddenly breaks into rivers. So you have a river of pedestrians going in one direction, a river of pedestrians coming in the other direction. It's a very efficient way of moving, but nobody's told them to do this. It just happens spontaneously.
What do you think causes this? Is this evolved, learned behavior? Is it hardwired in our DNA by now? Are we picking up on subtle cues that we don't even realize we recognize?
No, it's nothing to do with psychology. It's everything to do with physics. It's not something that's thought out. It's not something that's psychological. It's something that just happens. There was a wonderful experiment with some students. What they did was take a big circle, and the students were told just to walk around at random in this circle, just keeping within arm's length of each other. Now, around the outside of the circle, there was a series of cards, A, B, C, etc. And what the students didn't know is just a couple of their number had been told to walk around it more or less at random, but to make sure that they ended up next to the letter J. So after 10 minutes, these students who had been told ended up next to the letter J, and so did almost every other student, the ones that knew were there. Invisible leaders. It's amazing what you can do with that concept when you really start to think about it.
Yeah, I think the non-scientific way of putting that is people are sheep.
Well, not necessarily so. It's just that if they were told to keep within arm's length to each other, and there were a few that were heading in a different direction, that effect rippled through the whole group to take them all.
So how far could you extrapolate from that study to human behavior? Because it's very slightly frightening, suggesting that we're all more susceptible to invisible leadership than we might assume.
Well, we are. But I mean, you can take these parallels with the animal kingdom just so far. We are individuals. And if we can find some way of packaging our individual intelligence and our individual understanding to get it together so that it generates decision-making in the group as a whole, then that's a very good thing. And there's a number of ways to go about that.
For instance?
Well, one of the very simple ways is to take an average opinion of the group. And there's a classic experiment. I'll give you the simple experiment, which has been repeatedly done. Is you take a big jar full of jelly beans and ask a group of people to guess how many jelly beans there might be in the jar. Now, you get a whole wide range of guesses. But the remarkable thing is when you take the average of those guesses, and I say this has been proved again and again, that average turns out to be a lot closer to the right answer than almost all of the individual guesses within the group.
Well, so that's an example of the phenomenon we talk about, the wisdom of crowds, the idea that a decision based on what most people think is going to be better than what any single individual thinks. But then we also talk about the dangers of groupthink.
That's absolutely true. And the vital difference between the two is independence, because the only way in which this swarm intelligence, this group intelligence, can work effectively is if people are able to take individual judgments before they put them together without being affected by what other people think. So I've tried that jelly bean experiment myself in a group where I said to the people, why don't you talk among yourselves and try and work out what the best one is? Well, they were influencing each other. And of course, you had one strong character who was very insistent. So they all ended up pretty close to the one strong character's guess, which was miles away. And you can take this, you know, a long, long way. There's some rather worrying thoughts about it. One thought that I've had for myself, and I've not seen this studied, is in the performance of juries. Because you think the jury system, yes, that's a very, very democratic way of coming to a decision in a case, which can affect somebody's life very, very strongly. But in fact, when you look at the way that juries work, juries are very susceptible to groupthink. They're very susceptible through talking about the case, which has its advantages. You can say, hey, you know, here are the main points, and let's all bring in our own main points and try to discuss them rationally.
But there are often cases where there is that one strong individual in a jury who really pushes an agenda one way or the other. And then, of course, juries are sequestered, so it's very difficult for anybody to pull out and go think independently.
Absolutely. Now, there is a logical way around it, but it may not be a very practical way. And the logical way is for each juror to hear the case and make their mind up independently before they start talking with the other jurors. Now, how easy that would be to set up in our present society, I simply don't know.
Are there any other kind of practical uses to this science of complexity and swarm intelligence? I mean, are there principles you've pulled out that you use in everyday life?
One of the simplest, I think, is in making decisions for yourself. It turns out that just very simple rules, like if you've got a choice between two things and you recognize one of them, that's the one you go with.
Sort of like going with your first guess or the thing that seems the most familiar.
It is. But some people in Germany put their own money on the line when they came up with this. What they did was they went out into the street with a list of the companies who were on the stock market, the German stock market, and they showed this list to people and asked them which ones they recognized. And on the basis of that, they invested in the 10 companies which were most recognized, and they got a 45% return in the first year.
Whoa.
So
yes, I'd say it's a very, very practical application.
Well, I'm going off the point of swarm intelligence a little bit, but one that I really like is in choosing your life partner. Because if you work out how many likely people that you might meet, which ones are you going to choose? Do you choose the first person who feels like a really good partner? Or do you think, okay, maybe I should just hang on and see if I meet somebody else, which is what we advise our kids to do. But how long should you hang on? And there's a way of doing it, a mathematical way of doing it, which is equally relevant to shopping in markets.
I guess it's a kind of shopping.
Well, roughly speaking, work out how many chances you're going to get. Like if you're shopping in a market, there might be 100 shops with the thing you're looking for, and you're looking for the best price. Do you look in all those 100 shops? And apart from all the effort involved, you might find out that you've looked in all of them and gone back, and then the first one's been sold, so you've lost out. Or do you just take the first bargain that you find? The answer is that you look at one-third of the total possibilities and then choose the next one that's better than any of those.
It comes down to that precise a mathematical formula?
it does. In fact, when I say one-third, it comes out as the number pi, 1/π.
Oh, the mystical pi.
The mystical pi. Yeah, in theory, you could use the same sort of thing with the life partner. Okay, maybe I'm going to meet 100 people that I would really, maybe, want to get on with. But once I've rejected one, I'm not going to be able to go back to them. They'll be with somebody else. So what am I going to do? And the answer is, if you've got the courage and if you believe in mathematics and if you're willing to use mathematics to rule your life, is to wait until you've met 30-odd people out of the 100, and then the next one that you find who's at least as nice or good or wonderful as any of those, that's the person. Now, unfortunately...
And is this how you selected your life partner?
Yeah, but this mathematics doesn't work. It works for shopping, It doesn't work for life partners because the other person's also got a choice. When you buy a dishwasher, it doesn't choose you. But if you choose somebody, it might well be that they haven't chosen you.
Yes.
And so it sort of falls down there. But it's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Len Fisher joined us from Sydney, Australia. His book is called The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs.